listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhart. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I spoke with Terry Schilling. He's the executive director with American Principles Project. He and I talked about their Family First report that was just released yesterday. They believe that that Republicans should adopt a pro-family agenda in order to succeed not only in 2020, but also to continue to build the party in the years to come. So he and I had a chat about that. Before we get to that conversation, first a word from our sponsor, who is incidentally American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, Project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
Without further ado, here's my conversation with Terry Schilling. Hey, Terry, welcome to the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Shane. I'm always I always look forward to coming on with you.
Yeah, glad to have you on. I think this is your second or third time on. And, I think I might have to rename the podcast The Schilling Show because I had your dad on last week. So
you might have to do that. I mean, we both are huge fans of yours, and you're a good conservative. And I know my dad really likes you, and I know he had a great time on the other day.
Right, right. And I have to tell my listeners, this was not by design. So I didn't even think about it when I scheduled you on. It's like, oh, I had his dad on last week, and your report just happened to come out this week, so I wanted to talk to you about it. So reading through the Family First reclaiming the GOP's forgotten constituency reminded me a lot of you guys' 2013 rebuttal of the GOP autopsy of the 2012 election. Did you guys kind of have that in mind when you were first writing this?
This was essentially part two, this latest report, Family First. We knew that we pointed out in that first report, building a winning coalition, how the GOP can win in 2016 and beyond. And that autopsy was very simple. We pointed out, look, for the GOP to win, they've got to come up with a robust social agenda and take advantage of the left's radical agenda when it comes to abortion and marriage and family. And then at the same time, they need to have some type of populist economic platform that's geared towards working families, so to speak. And this is kind of that report 2.0. We've actually come to an understanding that the demographics of Hispanics or blacks or women, all of that is actually dependent on family structure. And okay, that's what we lay out in this Family First report, which is that family structure is paramount in for conservatives to outreach to anyone. And it's directly tied to how people vote, how they think, and whether or not they respect this constitutional system of government, natural law and constitutional order that we have in this country. It's really important to that. And that's what we're trying to focus on here.
Okay. So, I think one of the most compelling aspects of this report is, are the results from the survey. And I just have to, ask, it's like, how'd you guys decide on the questions? And there was like over 5,000 people selected. Basically, what does the demographics look like in terms of geography as well? I'm curious.
Yeah. So we worked hand-in-hand with one of my favorite people of all time, Dr. Mark Rignaris from the Austin Institute. He came up with most of the questions. And, he's a renowned social scientist. He had gotten a lot of notoriety in, I think it was around either 2011 or 2012, from a report that he did, a research project he did on family structures and social outcomes. So he looked at how family structures, whether it's married, divorced, separated, cohabitating, never married, divorced, remarried, there's like a dozen different categories. But he looked at how the children of those relationships all fare when it comes to crime and education and poverty, all of that, suicide rates, all of that. And we thought, you know, politicians are so shallow. It's so tough to get them to do the altruistic thing. So why don't we actually show them and look at how people vote based on family structure that they come from? And so Mark basically took that original report that he, or the original research project that he did, and he just framed it to be more political in nature. How do you vote? How do you think? What's your attitudes on free markets and taxation and government regulation and all of that? And what we really wanted to do was look at how children in these alternative households, like, you know, the married versus the married family, so never married and cohabitating, what are their attitudes on fiscal conservatism? Right? I mean, that's the most interesting thing here, is that people that come from those households, the never marrieds and the cohabitatings, they are socialists. And they don't like, you know, low taxes. And well, they do like low taxes, but they don't, they want a big government. And they
low
want
taxes,
more regulation.
Yeah, low taxes for me, but not for thee, basically, yeah.
Exactly. So we wanted to – look, the libertarian class in the Republican Party, and I'm speaking specifically to a lot of the donor class, they have this mindset of social issues killing us, and we just need to focus on fiscal and economic messages. Well, we wanted to show, hey, if you don't get the family right, and if we don't get people getting married and having kids again – all of your fiscal proposals and economic proposals, they're going to fall on deaf ears, because kids that are raised outside of traditional families, they are not conservative in the slightest. They don't even want a small government. They are socialists. And how I explain it is, you know, on the one end of the spectrum, with the married family with children, you've got Mike Pence and his three kids and beautiful wife. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you've got AOC. The never married, in her 30s bartender who is a socialist. And if we want to fix this problem long term, we've got to address the family formation crisis, because we have record low birth rates and record low marriage rates, and it's a real problem for our existence as conservatives.
Okay. You know, looking at some of the results, you know, pulling them on their looking at the 2016 results, it looked like. You note that, for instance, Trump lost the 20 to 65 age group among married voters by only 1.6%, but that gap increased in 2018 to 5%. You know, and Trump was approaching them with a socially conservative economic populist message. How do you bridge that 1.6%? How do we overcome that? How do Republicans overcome that?
So a big thing here is, you know, in the midterm election, I think it's almost every president except for George W. Bush, and I believe there's one, it might have been Eisenhower. Every single president has lost seats in Congress during that first
right,
midterm election.
Right.
It's very rare. And at the end of the day, you know, that 2018 midterm, you have to look at what's going on in the press and what the main topics of the day were. And at this time, it was looking like Trump was going to be impeached over the Russia collusion thing, and they had Bob Mueller, who's a Republican appointee. It just looked bad all around. And so, you know, I think that had Trump not had a socially conservative message in populist economics, I think that he would have probably lost even more seats. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think the preeminent issue was people wanted a check on the House of Representatives. And we also have to look at, you know, what the courts have done to these local districts. I mean, I know it's convoluted, but there are a lot of reasons why we lost the midterm elections. And I think that paramount to that is the fact that Republicans had not enacted the Trump agenda in Congress. I mean, they were the ones that were primarily punished. It wasn't necessarily Trump. And there were a lot of things holding him up. They weren't able to pass the wall. They did a lot of, they weren't able to do a lot of his agenda. And so I think that our voters just were frustrated and didn't show up at the polls. I think there's a lot of reasons why we lost that.
Okay. So, I know Democrats are pointing to Kentucky. They're looking at the Kentucky gubernatorial race. They're saying, hey, Matt Bevin was a social conservative. He also, embraced Trump. Was he populist too? I mean, but yet he lost in Kentucky. How would you respond to that in those comments?
Yeah, so Matt Bevin is such an interesting case because he you can't argue that he was a moderate or liberal governor, right? He was definitely a big-time conservative, and I'd argue that he's really is a populist. I mean, he wanted to do the right thing, but if you look at him, he took on a ton of really courageous fights. He kind of went into Kentucky like a bull in a china shop, willing to address any issue that needed to be addressed. And one of the first things he championed when he became governor was public pensions. Not a lot of people know this, but Kentucky has the worst funded public pension system in the country. And what that means is that Illinois and California and New York, their pension liability is going to be bigger. But they bring in more revenues, and they have a longer term to pay it all back. Kentucky doesn't have the revenues to make the amount of payments that Illinois and California and New York do. And so Bevin came in, went to address that. He touched almost every third rail fiscally and economically, and he was willing to fight his own party and to do the right thing. And you got to give him credit for being courageous, but I think that he could have done it in a more affable way, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
I mean, it's tough to criticize when you're not there. But I know that there was a lot of inter-party fighting. And, I mean, you know how these guys are in the establishment.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
When they've been there forever and a new guy comes along wanting to shake things up. And, the thing about Bevin is, and I think that Bevin's case actually – makes the point that conservatives do need a pro-family economic agenda that addresses the concerns of the middle class, and it can't just be fiscal conservatism and balancing the budget and cutting and slashing and spending. We've got to do something to appeal to families, because that was, I think, the one thing that Bevin was missing, was a compassionate pro-family economic agenda, and something. And when I say compassionate, I don't mean the compassionate conservatism
right.
George W. Bush. What I really mean is someone that's really dedicated and devoted to alleviating the economic burden of families in this country. I think if you're going to do the slash in spending and the cutting and all of that, you've got to make up for it in some type of economic plan to help out families.
So, looking at the at Trump again, you point out the two things, the trying to flip forward, building on the Trump coalition. You notice two things: Trump refused to adopt a true strategy on social issues, instead using social conservatism to his benefit. I've gotten a few remarks on Twitter about you're looking at Trump as the champion of family values. and I'm like, well, I didn't exactly say it like that, but. You have to be honest, he did champion these things. During 2016, I doubted whether or not how committed he was to it, or, mm-hmm. How much of this was just a political strategy and how much of this is actually a principle he actually holds to. But, to his credit, he's not only did he campaign on it, but he's following through on some promises as well. So. Plotting his lifestyle and his past behavior? No, absolutely not. But, I think it's wrong to, deny that he is fighting on social issues and he hasn't, raised the red or white flag.
Yes. And, I get it. I think it's an easy shot that people can take on Trump. You know, we know he's, you know, had a lot of women and has done a lot of things that, you know, are not really pro-family values. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that this is what has changed in the conservative movement and why the conservative movement was so, you know, strongly behind him. And there was just no stopping him in that 2016 primary. And what I think actually happened is the bulk of conservative voters made a conscious decision that they wanted to blow up the system. And instead of going with the guy who had all the appearances and, you know, had the nice family, had never had a whiff of adultery or anything, they went with the guy who was just honest with them. Yeah, he slept around, but you know what? He says he's going to do this, and I don't think he's lying to me. And to Trump's credit, while, you know, he probably slept with Stormy Daniels and all of that, he's had a very robust pro-family agenda. I mean, the nominees he's put on the courts, the economic package, you know, the tax cuts that he did, this is all really good stuff that's helping out families. You know, Jesse Waters was on Fox and Friends, and he pointed out this statistic, and it stuck with me today. So after 8 years of the Bush presidency, the average American family saw an increase in their household income of $400 a year. At the end of the Obama presidency, it was $1,000 at the end of his 8 years per year in their income. Hmm. After the first 2.5 years of Trump's presidency, the average American saw an additional $5,000 in their annual income. And when you tack in the Trump tax cuts, it goes up to $6,000. I mean, this is a guy who, yeah, I mean, he doesn't have, I mean, or he at least hasn't had the morals in the past, but he's getting the job done in a way that all of these other supposedly pro-family politicians have failed to do the job. And so when you're, you know, we're talking about personal lives versus public, you know, record on fighting on these issues, I think we have to do a better job of separating them. Because,
right,
quite frankly, I would take an unfaithful, you know, person or someone that had had extramarital affairs or whatever, like Donald Trump, who's actually proven to be someone that delivers and comes through at the end of the day on our issues, over someone who's never cheated on their spouse but is going to end religious freedom, take my kids away from me if they don't want to, if I don't want to give them a sex change, and have more abortions and pay for more abortions with our tax dollars. Like, we've got to separate out, you know, what someone's personal life is and what their personal values are, what they claim to be anyway. I mean, this is politics again, right? I mean,
right,
this is the game of faking and putting on a show and tricking people. Unfortunately, that's what it's been for the past few years. And
right,
I think we've got to look at the results and how someone actually votes when they're in office and the actions that they actually take as it pertains to public policy versus how they've lived their lives personally.
Right. And you know, as we're applying, as you're looking at the strategy and this agenda, I think it's important for, you know, maybe potential candidates to understand, too, that it's applying his policy agenda is one thing, but you don't necessarily, that doesn't mean necessarily act like Trump. Because one thing,
yeah,
I've
no,
seen,
that's right.
And one thing I've seen is that people who aren't Trump and try to act like Trump generally don't do well. So Trump can act like Trump because he's Trump, but that's not a winning strategy for anybody else,
right,
I've seen.
Well, again, and you know, the thing that for me when it comes to that is, I've noticed that I think you're onto something big here, in that when candidates try to be something that they're not, they typically fail. I think that the most successful candidates in politics, especially at the presidential level, have been those that are just most comfortable in their own skin. They're confident with who they are. They know what they believe. They know what they want to get done. And they're totally comfortable articulating that to the American people. I think that's why Trump is successful, is because he really is this guy that is, you know, he's not, I don't know that he's faking it when he's on TV. I can tell you there have been a lot of candidates, Scott Wagner in Pennsylvania, who ran for governor last year, who have mm-hmm. tried to be Trump, tried to be that brash, you know, braggadocio, macho man, but they don't end up being Trump because they don't have the charisma or they don't have the wit. They just come across as unlikable. People forget that President Trump is a likable guy. I mean, yeah, he might say mean things and everything, but if you're his friend and you say nice things about him, he's going to be really nice and affable towards you. But the other way around, you know, right. I wouldn't want to be on the other end of that stick. You know?
Right. Like, especially not on Twitter anyway. So, yes. So he going back to the economic, you know, message, things, comparing things that I thought it was interesting, the comparison of what Trump did compared to what Romney did. Because Romney was, yeah, definitely, it was job creation, job creation, job creation. I remember the 2012, you know, convention was all about, you know, I built this.
Yep.
And that just fell flat, obviously, because we don't have President Romney. So
well, we did the numbers on that actually, and I think the big reason why that fell flat, and I can't believe no one put this together, but only 5% of Americans ever even start a business. That's not even counting like the amount of Americans who start a business and fail. We're talking 5% of all Americans will ever start a business. That means that 95% of Americans are not going to do that, and they're just going to get a job. And they're going to work for a company, or they're going to work for their family business. It fell on flat ears because, one, it's not true. You know, yes, Henry Ford did, you know, was responsible for building Ford Motor Company. But you know what? He had thousands of workers who helped him build that company. And if he hadn't had those workers who dedicated their lives to that company, he would have fallen flat. And there would, and I remember Romney also mentioned Steve Jobs, and it's like, come on, man. I mean, yes, Apple wouldn't exist without Steve Jobs, but it also wouldn't exist without like thousands of Chinese workers who are working for like slave labor. Like, let's be careful about how we say this. He missed a huge opportunity, I think, to unite Americans, right? Because Obama was obviously trying to divide Americans from the employees and the employers. And Romney could have come across and said, look, we need these entrepreneurs, these people, these leaders that put things out there, but they need workers too. And President Obama stopped dividing us. This is part of the problem. This thing was a huge strike.
Yeah. Now, you know, looking at this, at the Trump coalition of you have social conservatives, conservative Catholics, evangelicals, as well as working class voters, particularly white working class voters. Some critics will say that Republicans, at least under the Trump coalition, are losing suburban voters. But are they gaining enough working or holding enough working class voters to be able to win in 2020? How would you respond to that?
Well, I think that Republicans do need to focus more on the suburban vote as well. I think that the tricky thing for Trump, as long as the economy keeps going well, people aren't going to vote on the economy. There's this weird thing where the economy is only an election issue when it's really bad.
That's true.
You know, when people aren't worried about their jobs and they're not worried about their neighbor's jobs or their family's jobs, they don't vote on it. They vote on other issues. And what I would recommend to Trump and the Republicans is look at your slate of issues. Look at where the Democrats have gone totally bonkers and, extract some pain there at the ballot booth. Democrats are way out of line when it comes to suburban America. I mean, really out of line. You just look at this sports issue with letting men claim to be women and then compete against these, you know, girls in sports. This speaks directly to soccer moms. I mean, you couldn't tailor a message more directed at soccer moms than when it comes to women's sports. It's an issue ripe for the taking.
You guys, and just full disclosure, I work with American Principles Project. I think most of my listeners know that, but just wanted to say it again. So we've really drilled down on that with the Kentucky governor's race with some ads and some polling. And you know, share a little bit about that and what you learned.
Yeah. So we identified around 400,000 voters who were persuadable to vote for Bevin. They'd actually move their vote when they found out that his Democrat opponent, Andy Beshear, supported letting boys identify as girls and compete in girls' athletics. And we targeted the heck out of them. We spent around $600,000 in digital advertising for them. And we're finalizing the after-action report today, and we'll be releasing it to the public. But it looks like we will have switched around 30,000 votes from Beshear to Matt Bevin. And what that amounts to is around $20 a vote, which is huge. I mean, really big. You know, in usual, on other issues and other organizations that I'm familiar with, they'll typically spend between $45 and $65 to persuade someone to vote for another candidate. So this is an issue that's really ripe for the taking. And I mean, if we can come into the state where, we have to be frank about these races so that we can learn and make as much progress as possible. The reason we got involved in this race was because Bevin needed the help. Like you said earlier, he had touched every third rail, every major issue. He was totally courageous and brave and wasn't afraid to take on these huge issues. But he was the most unpopular governor in the country as a result of that. And we knew it was going to be tight. We knew he was in trouble. But if we can come into a state like this and help out a candidate like Bevin, who had touched every third rail and was ranked the 50th most unpopular governor in the country, and get 30,000 people to vote for him over Beshear on this women's sports issue, we're going to have a heck of a time, a lot of fun in Michigan. We're going to have a lot of fun in Georgia, and we're going to have a lot of fun in North Carolina, because these other guys, like, they might be, you know, Republicans in purple and blue-leaning states, but they're not the most unlikable governor in the country, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that does. And just to reemphasize, these are 30,000 people that you flipped, right? They were in favor of Beshear before?
Yeah, so the 400,000 people that we identified, they were either supporting Beshear or undecided, leaning towards voting for Beshear. So we weren't wasting any money on people who had already made up their minds that they were going to vote for Matt Bevin. At the same time, we also weren't wasting any of our money targeting people who would never vote for Matt Bevin. This was only at people who were actually able to be persuaded towards voting for him.
And that's you know, excellent example of micro-targeting. And you know, just you consider the results of the race. It was like, what, 0.4%? Between only like five, you know, right around 5,000 votes separated.
It was right around 5,000 votes. Yeah, it was right around 5,000 votes out of 1.5 million cast.
So it would have been a lot worse without your
involvement. Yeah, a lot worse.
So
yeah, I think that's right.
Okay, so looking at 2020, and you know, we already mentioned that President Trump has fulfilled a lot of his campaign promises, or has attempted to fulfill a lot of his campaign promises. Obviously, he has to have Congress cooperating as well. But then the left has just gone absolutely bonkers, as we mentioned too. And I think a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with the Knights of Columbus and Marist College polling. I know I've talked about that. I know I've even written about that. The shift. How more and more people are identifying as pro-life. What jumped out at me, though, and I didn't see before, was GLAAD's polling. And for those of you who may not be aware, GLAAD is a pro-LGBT organization. I wasn't aware that more 18 to 34-year-olds are now unaccepting of homosexuality and LGBT issues. That was kind of eye-opening. You wouldn't expect that.
Yeah, it's interesting. Especially that type of candor from GLAAD. But, you know, how this whole thing works, you know, just how humanity works in general is it's a pendulum. You know, and the left wants us to think that, you know, they always repeat that saying, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. According to who? According, you know, I mean, we've had periods of great prosperity and peace and humanity, and then the Holocaust happens. You know, I mean, the evil makes a comeback sometimes, and you know, it's always going between good and evil and good and evil, and there are good times and there are bad times, and right now I think we're starting to see people. You know, they might have drank the Kool-Aid for a little bit on all of the LGBT and radical, you know, sexual revolution stuff for a little bit. But now they're starting to actually see how it plays out. You know, the sexual morals that we had, you know, all agreed upon from the founding of this country beforehand and up until, you know, about 20, 30 years ago, there was a reason for that. It wasn't just a random list of things that you should and shouldn't do when it comes to sexual relations and family. We had learned the hard way in many situations that sex is best left between a man and a married man and woman, and it really should have an openness to life. And marriage is about family and bringing new children into this world. And we're starting to see, you know, incredible numbers of abortions. We're seeing the divorce rate skyrocket. We're seeing the birth rate is now below replacement levels. Right. And what that means is that my generation and your kids' generation, we're not going to have a workforce to pay into Social Security for us. So we're probably going to have to work until we're 85 or 90 unless we all start having more kids. It's very problematic. It's very concerning. And I think that there will, as long as the sexual revolution is still going on and people are still trying to live that lifestyle and that, you know, pursue all of that, there's going to continue to be unhappiness and pain and misery. And I think more people are going to wake up to that and find that, you know, sex isn't making me happy. It might not
right.
be the path to making me happy that I thought it was.
Right, right. I want to shift gears a little bit and look at the actual, you know, agenda that you guys put forward. You know, it made me think of, I think some of our listeners are probably, maybe not all, because it was kind of a nerdy insider debate between David French and Sohrab Ahmari, between classic liberalism and a more, how would you describe Sohrab Ahmari's position? I don't want to mischaracterize it.
I would just say that it's a conservatism that is more open to using the levers of political power that voters entrust us with every election.
That sounds fair, I think. So, you know, maybe think, because one of the I have to, you know, I'm a David French. Well, when they did the podcast, I'd listened to his podcast. Now he's not with NRO, but one of the things I know that they mentioned, a criticism of this whole debate was, we weren't really debating specific policy issues. And I, you know, when I read this agenda, I thought, you know, here's some policies that I think we could probably find, I hope, some corroboration between, you know, the French, you know, folks, not that French necessarily thinks he has a following, but, and the Ahmari folks, you know, maybe some common ground, at least some points where we can have a conversation about the, you know, our differences, because I look at, for instance, parental rights. Obviously, both sides, you know, believe in that, right?
And I, you know, one of the things that I think was really unfortunate about that debate is that it became so personal,
right.
And was based on personalities. And you know, a clarifying moment for me when all this happened was at the debate at Catholic University of America, where they, you know, the whole debate started off over drag queen story hour, and Sohrab took a shot in First Things with an article lambasting French on the basis that he had wrote, you know, publicly that conservatives can't do anything about drag queen story hour because it's a matter of free speech and freedom of association, and there's just nothing you can do. You've just got to fight this culturally. And that was the main problem. And you know, after that article came out, French dug in his heels, you know, and said, yeah, no, there is nothing you can do about it. Well, obviously,
you're
dealing with children.
Yeah, nobody wants to backtrack.
Well, right. So it's just so tough. But in that debate, a clarifying moment that really struck me as being hopeful for working together in the future was when David French said that he thought conservatives could take action to regulate pornography, and that he didn't view that as freedom of speech. And that said to me, like, oh, this isn't actually a real big ideological divide. This just became too personal. And I think you're right in that the agenda that we've set out, I think there's a lot that the French crowd can agree with and get behind, and I think there's a lot that the Amari crowd can get behind and support. And hopefully we can bridge that gap. Hopefully I didn't get too into the weeds and piss off. I'm sorry, and upset enough people on the French side of the debate during that.
I'm sure no one's ears are bleeding by that. So that's I know my just a little trickle. It'll be okay. I'll go see a doctor later. So you know, parental rights is what you led with here, and talk about what this Parental Rights Act could look like. Now you obviously didn't get into. You didn't go too far into the weeds as far as talking about specifics in legislation because, well, that would probably short circuit any agenda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we want to go into this with an open mind. I mean, we have an idea of the ends that we want to accomplish, and right. So we want to lead with that. And, you know, we're seeing this happen across the country. I think the two primary concerns for me are medical decisions and as it pertains to education. So you're seeing these cases crop up where parents are losing custody of their children for not being supportive of gender transitions. And gender transition is just a nicer word for and a euphemism for sex change, because it's them putting these kids in these really confusing therapy sessions. They're getting these kids on cross-sex hormones. So, like, if you're a little boy – they'll put you on puberty blockers, and then when you decide which gender you want to be and you want to be a girl, they will actually start giving you estrogen. Now, I'm not a rocket scientist, but if I'm a boy and I identify as a bodybuilder and I want to take, you know, same-sex hormones like testosterone and steroids to get jacked, that's illegal. Even though that's what I personally wish for myself. So we've got to really – these are kids. These are, you know, people that we should not be experimenting on. You're having fully grown adults who made these decisions with a fully developed prefrontal cortex, you know, the decision-making part of your brain, and they're coming out now and regretting their sex change. So we just need to pump the brakes on that, and we definitely need to protect parental rights when they oppose a sex change for their kids. And the other aspect of this is the education aspect, and I think they're actually a little bit tied. So right now, school districts across the country, and you're seeing teachers be more vocal about this, they will actually say that parents don't know what's best for their children, that it's really the community that's responsible for raising these children. And there can't be a more antithetical American thing than believing that parents don't have the right to make decisions for their children. Children have no right. I mean, they have rights to be protected against abuse and neglect and abandonment, but they don't have rights to make decisions like this. I don't even let my kids, you know, decide what they're eating for dinner or decide how much candy they eat. Why in the world would I let them decide what gender they want to be? You know, it's absolutely crazy. My son Bobby, if this was up to him, he would be a dinosaur, like literally a dinosaur. And it's just absurd. And so we need to take back both of those areas and put parents firmly in charge. I think that a parent should be able to opt their child out of any offensive class in school. So if it's a sex ed class, if it's a weird, you know, LGBT history class that they're teaching in school, parents should get full autonomy when it comes to what their children are learning in school, because it's our duty and our responsibility to teach our children and educate them. It's not the schools. They have no right to undercut us. And so we'd like to do something on parental rights with those two areas.
One of the primary reasons why my wife and I homeschooled, and now actually all my kids are graduated and almost moved out of house. My oldest actually moved back in for briefly, but briefly, hopefully, knock on wood. It's important that parents understand. When I was a youth pastor, I was in youth ministry for 20 years. I would tell parents that, regardless of, you know, that you have to understand you, not the school, you know, are responsible for the education of your children. You need to be involved, whether you're in public school, whether you're in private school, whether you do homeschooling, you have to be involved. And to be able to be involved also means you need to be empowered to have choice and to be able to have a say. And yeah, it is really disturbing to see how public schools are, you know, maybe not overtly taking choice away, but like, for instance, you know, when making it very difficult to figure out when, how to opt kids out of certain things. With sex ed, right. I'd rather see an opt in rather than an opt out.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I'm sure you have a ton of parents listening, and I just want to really hone in on this sex ed thing because it's so important. As parents, you are the primary educators of your children, especially as it pertains to sex ed. Think about how, like, I know it's awkward, it's really weird, and no one wants to talk about it, but if you don't do it, some 25-year-old weirdo who wants to talk to your kids about sex, think about how weird that is. The person that wants to talk to children about sex is exactly who you do not want to talk to your children about sex.
Right.
These are weird people who have disordered lives, and we need to take it back and just, I know it's tough, but if you go into it with a funny attitude and, you know, a humble attitude, you can have a great time and make them laugh, you know, during the whole conversation.
Well,
but if you don't do it, weirdos will. And I mean,
right.
These people are weird.
Right.
Really
and
weird.
And I can attest it gives you funny stories to share, you know, talk about later in life, as my son and I reminisce about the talk we had when we were driving. And he's like, that was horrifying, Dad. So and I'm like, it was for me, too. So it's like, I didn't want to talk about it, but, you know,
right.
I didn't want him learning about it from his friends. So, yeah,
right.
So you're right. It's a conversation that parents have to take control of, and they can't abdicate that role. You know, looking at the agenda again, obviously there's some things that, you know, I think a lot of us expect, like abortion. So you got sound money in there that doesn't, you know, for people who aren't necessarily familiar, American Principles Project has always been, you know, involved with monetary policy. It's not necessarily been an issue you guys have been, you know, highly involved with of late, but it's still something you guys care about. So. How does sound
it's
money?
It's just impossible to drop it. It's almost impossible to ignore for us because the thing is, especially as it pertains to families, one of the biggest things that families are facing right now across the board is rising prices.
Yeah.
And that is all directly related to the Federal Reserve and sound money. You know, when we were under the gold standard, you know, a $20 gold piece, which was 1 ounce of gold, would get you a really fancy suit. And today, that same $20 1 ounce gold coin will get you that same quality fancy suit. And it's not the value of gold that changes value. It is the value of the dollar. And we, you know, there's a consequence to near zero interest rates. There's a consequence to, you know, printing and pumping more money than you have. And we've got to address it. It's the next big frontier in the economy, I think. And it's really tricky because it's the first thing that you should want to talk to if you want to put someone to sleep.
Yeah. One thing that jumped out at me. Well, you know, obviously you guys are talking about pornography, and I want to circle back to that. But the one thing that jumped out at me when reading the report was commercial surrogacy. I have to admit, this is an issue I've never thought about. What made you?
Yeah,
guys...
All right. So we're talking about the breakdown of the family, right? And we're talking about how it's all related to the breakdown of sex and. Commercial surrogacy, so people don't understand how this works. Basically, it's the buying and selling of human beings. It's like the 21st century of it. You can literally, if you're a single man or a single woman, you can literally go out and find a surrogate mother, pay her $25,000 to $50,000 to get inseminated and carry a baby to term for you, and then you're now the mom. Even though you have no biological connection or anything, you are now the parent of a kid who has no biological tie to you. And the real thing for us is that, you know, sex should be done within marriage and with an openness in life, and children are so important, and children have a right to know their biological parents. And, you know, adoption is like the greatest thing of all time. I mean, it's like the most saintly thing I think a human being can do. It's so self-sacrificial, and you're doing the Lord's work. But, you know, surrogacy, there are so many, you know, kids that need to be adopted. And surrogacy is just, it's a slap in the face of that, of what children are really meant for. That children are not puppies. They're not animals. They are human beings, and they have rights, and they have a right to know who their parents are. They have a right to their parents. And
well,
it's
something
how
I thought
surrogacy laws are crafted. A lot of times they take a right, the child's right to ever even know who his or her biological parents are. I mean, the reason we got involved in this is because it's part of the breakdown of the family. It's part of the breakdown of society. And these kids, I mean, imagine growing up, turning 15, 16, 17, 18 years old, and coming to realize that your parents aren't actually your parents, and you have no idea where you came from. Biology matters, and your ancestry matters. It's really important. So that's the major reason why we got involved in it.
Okay, and another thing I thought of when I was considering this, reading through the report, is, you know, at least with adoption, there's screening that happens, right? Not so with surrogacy. I mean, it's whoever, you know, pays whatever I'm asking. And you don't really, at least, you know, maybe there's some that do some basic screening, but I'm doubtful of that. Also, too, it seems like same sex couples probably use this more than, say, you know, opposite sex couples, I would assume.
Definitely. And, you know, that creates a lot of complications as well. And it was something that's very interesting about family and having children and this issue of surrogacy is, you know, granted, we might get the technology in a few years, and okay, we'll deal with that when it comes. But as it stands right now, you can really only make a baby with one man and one woman and the genetic material from each. And I think the real problem with surrogacy and gay couples is that, you know, when my wife and I have a baby, that child is literally 50% of each of us. And it's a uniting thing. There's not a single thing. I mean, we'll joke and say, well, he didn't get that from my side of the family.
But
the child is a uniting thing in a family. It brings the mom and dad closer together. But when you're talking about surrogacy, where the child belongs to one parent or the other, it is actually like a division point. And there are serious issues there. You know, can you imagine being in a relationship where you're raising another person's child, basically? It doesn't look like you. It doesn't act like you. It becomes a potential issue for division. And I think we need to be very careful about how we treat that. And I think that just by eliminating the ability to buy babies, we can do a lot to protect these children.
Great. I know, running out of time that you have allotted here. So I just want to ask you about pornography. What is it that you have in mind in there? What would that look like? And how much traction do you think we can get on this issue?
What I'd ideally like to see is to have the internet treated like every other medium in the country. And what I mean by that is, you know, when you go to the movies, you get the option to go see a G-rated movie, a PG-rated movie, a PG-13 or R or whatever. When you go to the internet, you don't know what you're getting into. And they have all these crazy websites. And so what we'd like to do is get a system in place where through your ISP, you can say, I want PG-13 rated internet. I want PG rated internet. I want X rated internet, unfiltered. And give parents those tools to protect their children. You know, the Congress actually passed a law in the 90s called the Communications Decency Act. And the Supreme Court, as you know, they just have such great foresight, and they're just such great elite leaders and able to predict the future. They struck it down, and they said that age verification of putting in a credit card posed an undue burden to the porn consumer. And they also said, John Paul Stevens said, the internet is not as pervasive as television or radio. And I think if you look at where we are today, that's a joke. Right. Almost every person in the country has a smartphone with high-speed internet access. I think it's around 75%, and that includes a lot of children. And we've got to do something to restrict this monstrosity that has become online pornography. I mean, not only is it everywhere, but it's really, really weird. I mean, porn's always weird, but they're coming out with really, really weird stuff now.
And it's addictive. And a lot of times kids will stumble onto this without even realizing it. It's one thing if you're an adult and you're seeking it out intentionally, but kids, they're not looking for this stuff, but they run into it, they encounter it. It's important, I think, to give parents tools and the ability to empower them to be able to restrict. You know, I would encourage parents. I don't think your kid needs a smartphone when they're, 12,
my goodness, no, I think
13,
it's child
14.
Abuse. It's not good.
My kids didn't have a smartphone until they were like 17, 18. And obviously parents need to monitor screen time and all that. And we had rules set up in our house. So I think parents need to do all that. But definitely having a filtering option at the ISP level would certainly help and give
parents
an additional
tool.
Yes, I think
so. And I, some of the feedback I've gotten, I've gotten mostly positive feedback. Mostly circulated among the conservative movement, but even a lot of my liberal friends will say, I think porn is a big issue that we should tackle. And they're more coming at it from the human trafficking and the exploitation of women standpoint, which that's awesome. I'm with you. I want to address it for that reason too. But I'm also really worried about what it's doing to our boys and how it's changing the way they view women and also sex. I mean, sex is such a great thing, and porn is such an opposite of that. I mean, it's something that you share with someone else, and porn is like totally about you, and it's like a weird, weird thing. But anyway, I'm very hopeful for something like this. I think ultimately my end goal with what we want to get done with the internet is to have it be like our neighborhoods, have it be like a reflection of modern society, where I can let my kids run out free in my neighborhood and not worry about them getting shot, not worry about someone abducting them. They can go to their parents or their friend's house, and they can go play in the park, and I can know they're safe. I think we should have an internet that's reflective of something like that. If you want to go to the seedy part of town, fine. But you got to show age verification, you can't get access to it without it. And, the ironic thing about the Supreme Court is they said that forcing someone to provide age verification with just typing in a credit card number, not even paying for anything, is an undue burden. Well, how is it not an undue burden for families to be forced to pay extra money every month for a filter?
Right.
I mean, I shouldn't have to pay extra money to protect my children. You're the one that wants the weird stuff. You should have to pay extra for that. We're the majority, not you guys. And I think a lot of men would actually be supportive of heavily restricting it, maybe even further than what we want to do.
Well, I mean, a lot of men are addicted to this, and it's not that they necessarily want to be. I think men who are struggling with this would welcome this because it would be an additional layer of accountability, and it would make it that much harder to access.
Yep.
Anyway, hey, Terry, thank you so much. And you guys can learn more by going to AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. I also have a link up at Caffeinated Thoughts on the podcast page as well. So thank you so much for joining me. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Shane. We'll talk soon.
Yep. Have a great weekend.
Yep. Bye.
Bye. That concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com. CAFFEINATED. Had to think about it for a second. Maybe I'm not caffeinated enough. Again, Caffeinated Thoughts, or you could just search for it and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to check us out on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our emails. That way you don't miss a single update. You can also subscribe to this podcast in a variety of ways. Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, SoundCloud, Stitcher. If you listen and subscribe to any one of those, please be sure to give us a great review. If you don't like what you hear, please forget that I said anything. Seriously, though, I appreciate any reviews, but I especially appreciate 5-star or, you know, excellent reviews, too. So we need those. That way our podcasts, have better reach. So until next time, my friends, again, this is Shane Vanderhart. Have an excellent weekend. Take care, everybody.